Hi listeners, before we begin, remember that we've got a Patreon running at patreon.com/about_buildings, where for $3 a month you can get bonus content with every episode. On this episode's bonus, we're going to be talking about design after Ruskin, the later 19th century arts and crafts, William Morris, and all that kind of lovely stuff.
And a big thank you to everyone who's been supporting us. And we're going to get some new microphones and stuff, so the sound is a little less crappy.
Yeah, it's happening.
It's going to happen. We're going to use those hard-earned dollars of yours.
Glacially slowly. If you're one of our premium subscribers, the print is on the way.
Is it?
Well, it will be soon.
It will be soon. It will be soon. I wanted to do one as well. Heavens knows when.
You should get it before Christmas. All right. Now come with me, for I am keeping you from your gondola. I think you must have fallen asleep. I see the book slipping out of your hands and lodging itself against the back of the seat in front, enmeshing it in the bundle of cards depicting sudden and unplanned descent. Beyond your nodding head, the lattice-like contrails left by other travellers etch themselves in gold onto the azure sky over Garda. A chime announces our inevitable descent towards Padua, towards the queue at passport control, towards the baggage carousel eddying out of the murk behind the rubber curtain, towards the sodium-lit platform, the half-hourly express, through fields of dusty vines and skulking sheds. At the station, we keep our distance from noisy disagreements over unfranked tickets. Around us, wheeled suitcases jump and skitter over the stones like so many rats. At the entrance, the crush becomes intense, a slow-moving and aimless procession. In panic, we cross the first bridge we come to, hurry down a street through one yellow-painted courtyard and then another. The blue line on the smartphone screen pulses impotently and goes out. We are lost. But at last, through an archway, we see water, and what appears to be a vast white wall, drawing itself slowly across the scene beyond, like a curtain, a sullen cloud of smoke drifting out of its vent. And beyond it, clearing, in the last of the light, the white face of a church glowing softly above the darkening water. You're listening to About Buildings and Cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Kinjal.
And yeah, you rejoin us. This time we are actually going to get onto the stones of Venice.
We're going to start on them.
We're going to have a go. In the last episode, we had a good old discussion of how to be a Victorian and various other formative factors, but we didn't really make a dent in it in any meaningful way. He begins the first volume with this chapter called The Quarry, and he means the quarry kind of as in the target, doesn't he?
Well, I think it means both, because the next one is the foundation, and he's talking about the movement of the stone all the way through as well. It may be that he also means that.
He's quite clear that what motivates the book is the desire to tell the story of what has gone wrong with architecture. He pathologizes the sort of state of architecture in the industrial metropolis of London, and he wants to go in search of the question of how it got there.
And he says why this is very important. This is very important because the decline in our arts and representation is inextricably linked to the decline in our civilization.
Yeah.
And he thinks our civilization is taking a nasty turn, and we must be most mindful.
That's something which we're going to find, is that art is a true window onto the nature of the civilization which produces it. Maybe I'll just read this little... I've got this edition which I had since university, when I did a project on this a long time ago, and it's got all of these rather... laboriously like coloured it. I haven't just underlined things, I've kind of coloured in the text in some.
Were you into that back then?
I don't really know. I was obviously giving it a go. But maybe I'll just read this little quote from there. He says that now Venice, as she was once the most religious, was in her fall the most corrupt of European states, and as she was in her strength the centre of the pure currents of Christian architecture, so she is in her decline the source of the Renaissance. It was the originality and splendour of the palaces of Vicenza and Venice which gave this school its eminence in the eyes of Europe. It is in Venice, therefore, and in Venice only, that the effectual blows can be struck at this pestilent art of the Renaissance. Destroy its claims to admiration there, and it can assert them nowhere else. This, therefore, will be the final purpose of the following essay. Now, when he says final, we're going to reach that part of the essay in volume 3. And we've got 2 very long volumes to get through before we get there. It's highly possible that we won't actually get on really to the scourge of the Renaissance in this episode at all.
I'd like to if we can. I've realised actually that the first thing is you're reading this incredibly long book. He's got very firm ideas about things that you don't really need to have firm ideas about. This is very interesting. And now I think we probably want to skip over quite a lot of that and just give people a taste of it, because really the thing that's interesting is why would anyone write this? There's good stuff in there, but there's also, it's a plodding work, isn't it?
There are definitely delights, but they're kind of sprinkled, kind of far and wide.
It's very difficult to skim read because it's very long and boring, and then he'll suddenly very quickly, in a sentence, say something interesting.
I think we mentioned this in the last episode, but it's absolutely a characteristic of Ruskin to say he's going to do something and then take a very long time about getting there.
It's definitely someone brought up on long evangelical sermons. He's got the prodigious and immediate talent for purple prose and argument by attrition.
Obviously, this quote identifies this target of the essay, and so the essay is going to be a great piece of iconoclasm directed against the sort of the status of the Italian Renaissance as this extraordinary cultural exemplar and high point and source of the kind of rediscovered architectural truth. I mean, like, people still sort of think about it that way.
If you type in art, you get the Mona Lisa. If you type in sculpture, you get David. If you type in architecture, there's probably a pediment. And actually, he's got a bigger project. He wants to punch out the Italian Renaissance, but also take down with it lots of things around it which he doesn't like the Enlightenment, the division of labour, industrial production, the moneyed economy, philosophy, any sort of academism, not just in architectural style, but in thinking full stop. It's all interlinked.
Some of this introduction is quite amusing. He has this line that very few faults of architecture are mistakes of honest choice. They are almost always hypocrisies, by which he means that there's a sort of false consciousness of fashion and taste that's going on. And he has this long diatribe where he says, "Do you seriously imagine, reader, that any living soul in London likes triglyphs?" By which he's referring to this funny little motif that you get in the architrave of kind of neoclassical architecture.
It's one of those things that you don't really need to notice.
And if you do focus your whole attention on them, they're sort of pointless.
I don't know. There's a way of enlivening that bit of the entablature or whatever. They can be quite handsome as part of is it the abacus that's that bit? He will occasionally literally say, "Satan has laid and here Satan lays another trap to entangle the minds." He says that like 2 or 3 times in the book, which is very long. But that really is the only explanation that he gives as to why people prefer this, is that they have been sort of led astray by the devil. Sorry, I've just been reading some of those bits recently and it surprised me. The devil isn't commonly ascribed as the reason for a cultural development in our day and age.
I think we could kind of go on to what the first volume is about. His rationale is sort of as follows. if people can only start making honest choices about what they like in architecture, they will naturally agree with him. But in order to do that, he first has to tell them what architecture is. And his mode of doing this is basically the whole of the first volume, with the exception of a little sort of dreamlike passage, which you may have heard towards the end of last episode. What he's going to do is to talk about what architecture is in its elements in great detail.
And I think what he's doing here is everything in the world is good because it's created by God. Humans naturally enjoy it, but they've been led astray by classicizing influences, various things, the sort of systems of knowledge of his day, which will set up these things which he would like regard as, you know, glasses that mean you can't see the truth anymore. You can't see what you naturally knew in your heart anyway. And so he's going to synthesize as an intellectual exercise architecture from nothing in a completely different way. I would think that's sort of what he regards the project as. He's explicitly doing it not in the way that the textbooks would do it, although he doesn't say that. But I think that's what the project is, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I might read out the list of chapters to give you an indication of how this works. So, it's very long. As an example of these sort of elements, we've got the wall base, the wall veil, the wall cornice, the pier base, the shaft, the capital, the arch line, the arch masonry, the arch load, the roof cornice, the buttress, form of aperture, filling of aperture, protection of aperture, superimposition, the material of ornament, treatment of ornament, the angle, edge and fillet, the roll and recess, the base, the wall veil and shaft, the cornice and capital, the archivolt and aperture, the roof, the vestibule.
And on. That didn't start at the beginning.
I mean, we should also say that during the research period for this episode, you elected to listen to the unabridged version of The Stones of Venice in its entirety. And during this volume, you were very unhappy.
I wasn't reduced to tears with boredom, but I wasn't necessarily far off at some points. We cannot convey in the limited scope of this podcast how long and boring these sections are.
They're very significantly pruned in the various abridgments.
You get things like an appendix where he says, and, for example, in this church, we can discuss whether the relevance of shafts and the shaft expansion is such and such, and I'm going to do that by measuring the diameter of every single column in the church and telling you them one by one, and then saying it's not of any particular importance. Or, you know.
He's got a sort of interesting different sorts of methods of proof, doesn't he?
Everything has to be divided up. This goes through the whole book, actually. Everything is, he gives a taxonomy. He invents taxonomies for everything. And those taxonomies are essentially fractal. And often pretty strange and arbitrary. You know, the column capital has two forms, the concave and the convex. And that is the fundamental division of all column capitals, except it would probably call them shaft capitals, because the word shaft...
There's a lot of shaft, yeah.
Almost every paragraph. There's lots of shaft and quite a lot of superincumbent weight. Things are demonstrated because of the force of the superincumbent weight upon them.
We could have a look at the wall and column parts, which I think also tell you a little bit about his method of argument here, which is, well, what could you say?
He's definitely been thinking about it on his own for a very long time.
But equally, it's completely unsystematic. It's just sort of...
Like, it's not like there's two people sitting, chatting with each other, pushing back. No, he's obsessively and slightly crazily gone round and round in circles in his head, developing this more and more complicated idea. There's no one telling him, what are you doing?
Well, so here's a little quotation from the start. A wall has no business to be dead. It ought to have members in its make and purposes in its existence, like an organized creature, and to answer its ends in a living and energetic way, and it is only when we do not choose to put any strength nor organization into it that it offends us by its deadness.
That's quite a nice bit there. Most of it is like this is the bit that's after wall bases, I think, isn't it? So we've had foundations and he's derived them and how they are, and then he's derived wall bases, and then we can get onto walls.
He's trying to say that there's a proper way of doing things, which is sometimes common sense. Yeah. Like, imagine you're the person in this position. You would put the biggest stones at the bottom and then work upwards. So it's natural to have big stones at the bottom of a foundation and then for there to be smaller stones which are laid on top of them, which is rather how the kind of foundation courses of walls in certain Italian hill towns are.
Yes, and he likes to illustrate that sort of thing with handy examples of... And now take for yourself a piece of paper and fold it into 8 pieces and see if it stands up, if you crinkle it or if you just, you know... All that sort of thing. Famously, later on, we've got how to carve a Corinthian column capital out of Gruyere cheese, which I might put in somewhere. It's a good one. It's not in this book, it's in another one of the books.
So, yeah, the use of larger stones at the base is the natural thing to do.
Building practicalities.
At other times, the justification is a metaphorical one. So it's that the wall is like an animal.
It's like a man.
Yeah, it's like a man, or it's like a beast, or, you know...
A career as well. It's like a man both physically standing the wall, if I remember rightly, and also like a man's career through... like the bottom is childhood.
Yeah.
And then you've got to have a stringer course when you leave school and get your prize. And then you've got to go up and you have a period of hard work where you're supporting, and then you're awarded another prize and you get another stringer course, and then you go to university.
He's referring to the practice of doing brick walls with bands of stone masonry in them.
But also a stone wall must go up and then have a band of stones like a dado rail along it. Otherwise, it's dead.
All of the metaphors reinforce one another. So it's, but you know, on the page I'm on, it says that the foundation of the wall is like the paw of an animal. But equally, sometimes there are these sort of geological justifications, or as you say, there are these sort of funny analogies with the lifespan of a person, or all these sorts of ideas, and all of the metaphors coexist and sort of sing in harmony with one another to reinforce the general
message. And what sort of buildings do you think he's describing? Because he describes it as universal. This is universal.
It doesn't sound universal. It sounds like Verona. That's what I'm thinking of.
It's only stone churches, almost. like 90% churches. That's sort of what he's imagining when he talks about architecture. Yeah, and in other bits he's talking about Venice. He's not really interested in buildings with multiple stories or what goes on in small rooms or anything like that. Basically unmentioned. And he doesn't describe floors.
I'm not sure if I have a good quote from it, but there's a bit where he justifies the use of, yeah, of kind of banded masonry with reference to the Matterhorn, within which you can see these like bands of iron inside the rock face.
Yeah, yeah, the sort of bands of rust in the rock face. It might not be the Matterhorn, it might be another cliff in the Alps.
But he has, it's interesting, because at the same time he's very much against masonry which is too mannered, or which sort of seems to kind of express or prettify itself too much. So he thinks that masonry should be an expression of structure. All of these attractive kind of ornaments to it, like these bands, are in fact expressing structural requirements. He says, masonry is always bad, which appears to have arrested the attention of the architect more than the absolute conditions of strength require. And everyone knows a building is built of separate stones. Nobody will ever object to seeing that it is so, but nobody wants to count them.
Well, that's part of a long essay he's got, which is against one thing, actually, which is carving around the edge of stones to inset them, or around having rusticated stones with flat, sharp edges, which he finds really offensive. And he explicitly writes a whole essay, the whole section in there, on how you should decorate, you should have carvings all over walls to decorate them, but they mustn't be about making the stones explicit, because the stones have got to act together. It's really, that thing I would really say is just about that. He hates it when people carve out little notches to show how big the stones are. And so he creates an entire theory to say why that's bad, but he doesn't use that theory anywhere else.
This kind of justification or kind of philosophizing around what is essentially just matters of personal taste is very characteristic, but kind of amazingly ingenious as well. So as we kind of keep ascending the wall and we get up to the cornice, where we encounter two things which I want to talk about. One is that there is, so this is the, you know, the stone that goes on top of the wall, which kind of caps it.
Don't let him hear you say that. He defines it for about 3,000 words.
I know, the cornice is a long section, and it's interesting for the appearance of a couple of things. One is kind of almost evolutionary justification of the way in which they're formed, so that it's through stages he gets to why cornices in Gothic architecture look a particular way, how they've evolved simultaneously under the requirements of supporting load forces and also drips, and, you know, channeling water, you know, just getting the drips away from the wall. Throughout this section there are lots of diagrams, but in the cornice section they kind of start to multiply. There is a great wealth of these little line drawing.
God, the bit I can remember from the wall cornice is this extremely long essay against mock battlements, different types of mock battlements and how they're probably acts of Satan as well. And he's like, what self-respecting medieval archer would use this battlement type when clearly the things to hide behind aren't big enough for a man?
Well, indeed, yeah. Oh, I just wanted to say about the illustrations. So they are, I mean, they are rather lovely. I think it's, there's like little sections through the wall.
There's tons of small illustrative section profiles. So he'll have a whole page, and on that page there will be 30 sections through a moulding. The edge of a column capital, or the column base, which is a long chapter. All of which are real examples.
Yeah, he will have collected, surveyed them all on his various travels. It's kind of interesting because, apart from anything else, we're not really in Venice at the moment, are we?
Not really at all. The first chapter really doesn't take place in Venice. And he sort of says explicitly, he's talking about an amalgam. In England, he mentions Salisbury Cathedral a lot. And very seldom any other book. Buildings in a positive light. He talks about a few cathedrals in France. Vienne comes up a few times, which is been to. It's a not terribly exciting Gothic cathedral on the Rhone.
On the like motorway going down the Rhone.
He talks about Verona. And occasionally, like, well, he doesn't say which ones they are, he'll talk about German towns. And that's really, when he says he's creating an idea of universal building, it's really those things.
He very deliberately does something when he talks about columns, which is to talk about the column as something which can be condensed from the principles of a wall. The column is just like a wall. It's got the same sort of members, but it's condensed to a point.
Essentially, he's talking about the row of columns, of which there are two inside a church.
But it's also, I mean, it's also very deliberately against classicism again, isn't it?
Well, I was just going to say that. If you were going to derive the columns around a Greek temple, the classical thing to say is, well, the original ones, they were sort of tree trunks that had been circularized, and then you have a roof over them. There's no wall anywhere. But in a church, if you're thinking of deriving the columns in a church, there's a bit of wall above them, and there may even be a bit of wall below them, and they separate one bit of a room from another bit of a room. So in a way, if you look at it long enough, you kind of can see how they're cut out from a wall. And he wants to, as you say, be anti-classical. The column is this really crucial thing in classicism because it's like a person. The orders of architecture are very centered around the different representations of the column, and he thinks the orders of architecture are terrible. So he wants a whole new way of thinking about them. I mean, he actually says, first we have buttresses in the wall, and then we can thin down the bit between the wall buttresses until it's just a screen, and then we can take it out entirely. And then if we replace the buttress of little stones with a circular strong stone, it can be made thinner. Hey presto, you've got a column. And then he says, but this isn't how columns came into being. Of course columns came into be- columns exist in the rude shepherd's hut, and they're just a tree. But this is sort of a justification.
Well, it's just an inversion of, yeah, kind of classical hierarchy, isn't it? In which the columns are like the structuring formal element, and walls are subordinate. Yeah. Certainly, you know, in the temple or whatever, it's set out by how many columns it has, and then there's a little walled enclosure inside that. And likewise, yeah, in neoclassical architecture, columns and pilasters are used to sort of structure what's otherwise the blankness of the wall, to break it up, to add rhythm to it.
And he wants to have a theory that's based around walls. But as we've described, his theory of walls is inconsistent and sort of fluffy and made up of lots of little...
Yeah, well, it's very... Yeah, it's like romantic, isn't it? It's very... Yeah. It's
and
very
arbitrary.
Romantic.
It's just sort of arbitrary digression. It's like a series of digressions.
It's no less arbitrary a derivation than the classical one, though. If we're thinking about Adam's house in paradise, there's no more reason to think of it as built out of tree logs than there is to think of it built out of wattle and daub, or, you know, stones in a row or whatever. Do we want to talk about other stuff to do with columns? There's an awful lot of them, and I think most of it's been taken out of my edition.
Shafts. And then there's an awful lot of... Oh God, this is quite a lot while I was reading this. To give you an idea. So first we have to, rather like the wall, we go up the column. And we start with the column foot and the base, and there's lots of complicated evolution as to why it should be... It sort of goes, well, obviously we would just have it circular, but this is ugly, so we have it square. God, then he goes through long, complicated lists of profiles of the bit at the bottom, which are derived from nature. And then why it's got to have four little things on the corners, and then how it can also be a wall. And then he goes up, sort of, and he talks about the shaft for a long time. And in there, he's talking a lot about how it can be one, or you can have two next to each other, or you can have four little ones, or you can conjoin the four little ones, and you can have a sort of fractal pattern of little bits of column coming out of column. Yes. Or something he thinks that the West has done wrong and Italy has done right is that the column can have a twist in it, which is good if it's got one half twist across its whole length, but not good if it's twisted lots of times, like those candy cone ones in a Baroque building, which he thinks is very bad. There's a lot of talk of... Is column capitals in that section? Column capitals is very long. The first thing he says is there are two kinds of column capitals, Doric and Corinthian. Doric is convex, and Corinthian is concave. And all columns... in every place in the world and at every time are either Doric or Corinthian. And
I think that's just a bit more kind of shit-stirring, isn't it?
Yeah. And he talks a lot about, you know, whether the column is made of masonry or made of a single stone and what makes a column magnificent. The solid stone marble ones are really amazing, and it's okay if they're slightly different heights and you're putting them in from a different building. That's okay. Whether you taper or not taper, to taper is good, not to taper is a sign of rudeness. He'll sort of go through the examples and say which ones are bad and which ones are good, and say, if you want to understand good Gothic architecture, his axes are like precision versus rudeness. He thinks something good can be anywhere along there. Another axis is truth and dishonesty, or truth and corruption. Anywhere on the true axis is good, and that almost nothing is true and precise, but there are a couple. But if it looks precise, you should probably assume it's bad. Like, that goes for walls and columns and column bases and all these things. He will always say which one he likes best. You know, these are the different column bases. It's getting most complicated. Here is the point where it reaches its perfection. In the case of a column base, if I remember correctly, it's square. And then there's a sort of donut shape. And then on the donut shape coming out of it, on each corner is a leaf pattern coming, pointing into the corner. And the leaf pattern is carved, I think, in the shape of a naturalistic leaf without too much detail. I think that's the peak of column bases from which they decline. There's an illustration of that.
Yeah, of course. I might say something about arches. There's this nice quotation which I remembered, where he makes the moralistic analogy about physical forces. He says that the arch line is the moral character of the arch, and the adverse forces are its temptations. And the voussoirs, which are the stones in the arch, carved stones, and what else we may help with it are its armour and its motives to good conduct.
And then there'll be a long bit where he'll try and explain the force line.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit tangled because he does want... He does like this, the arch with the little... Is that an ogee? Ogee? Where you have the arch with the little sort of curling backwards point at the top.
So he really wants the one where it... where the arch has got a sort of foil, you know, like a spike.
Little sort of foliated.
Yeah, which he says
thing.
Are probably for structure originally.
Yeah, well, which are completely unstructural.
And,
yeah,
offer no additional strength.
So this is the one with the little sort of arch with the little ball kind of right on the top in the position of greatest stress. Yeah, if it was an arch. Yeah, the other thing I noticed about then was that we start to encounter this distinctive dismissal, which is the excrescence, which is applied to whenever there's a thing which he thinks crosses over from beauty, necessity, naturalness, commonsensicalness, whatever it happens to be, the expression of truth, it becomes an excrescence. And it can be quite difficult to tell what's an excrescence and what...
Later on, he says, apertures can have a square top, a round top, a bulgy round top, or a pointed top. The worst of these is the square top, which is completely impractical. If you go around London, everywhere you will see cracks above square-topped things, and you also, whenever you look at them, you imagine the whole thing caving in. But I have been around Verona, where many of the windows have Gothic points above them, and none of them have ever cracked over the hundreds of years they have been standing. Now, of course, people will say, but you can't fit a sash window in underneath a Gothic point. That's fine. You can just board the extra bit up.
Yeah.
A lot of the time in this volume, he's wanting to give people pointers as to if they're looking at a Gothic building and they're unsure of whether they like it or not. He wants to tell them the things to look out for to know if they like it. So if it's got a Gothic pointed top of the arch, it's okay for a good building to not have that in some places for reasons of cheapness. But if it has it, you can tell if it's good or not, because it must, if it has it, have a little sort of nodule or capital at the bottom of the arch spring.
Okay.
If it's not, it's bad. A sign of inferior work or corruption.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's very difficult, isn't it? Because we're caught between the sort of Scylla and Charybdis of, on the one hand, deadness, and on the other hand, excrescence. And we have to tread like Christian in Pilgrim's Progress on a very narrow and winding path between the two.
The arch that he's most happy with is a Gothic arch, and it's got to have capitals at the springs, so at the bottom of the arch as it goes up. And then he's discovered in a few places that they did this absolutely marvellous thing that they put a little heraldic shield at the top, which covers the sort of modesty of the pointy bit, which he thinks somehow has got a bad energy about it. But the fact that it's got this shield at the top pointing down balances the whole thing out and makes it perfect.
Oh, okay. I don't think there's any way we can really do justice to it. I think it's perfectly acceptable to just look at the pictures, which I think are rather nice, and maybe in some ways you don't really need to know what they're about.
It's so hard doing this because he says so many things.
Yeah.
In this section. The general tempo of the text is it's very boring.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There are ups and downs and more downs than ups. It is quite difficult to sum up what the sort of... I think that's something which we'll do more when we get onto the nature of Gothic in Volume 2. But at this stage, apart from being anti-classical and being against lots and lots of things, and having lots of things which are sort of a favoured light as shone onto, it's quite difficult to condense, or really impossible to condense the principles.
He never talks about a building as an example. He's deriving the elements of a building. He never says, if you go to this church, you will see the church has this quality. He only focuses on details. So he will say, here are five windows. Wrong, semi-wrong, barbaric, but with the correct spirit. Well, the window is too general, actually. Here are six Venetian balcony balustrades.
Yeah.
We have the first type, which you won't see anywhere, and probably doesn't exist anymore, which is just three pieces of stone. And then you'll have this sort of cutout, this sort of cutout, this sort of cutout. This one comes from this, this one comes from this. This is an improvement, and this is barbarism. Something that's so frustrating with this is you never get to a building. There's almost no discussion of space. There's almost no discussion of proportion. He's very much more interested in line. And you never get to a building. You're just fixated on
all these little details. Yeah.
Another thing, you know, you'd really get the idea that what is a building? A building, yeah, it's got stone walls, a row of columns, a few windows, a door, and a massive archivolt. And that's...
What is an archivolt?
An archivolt is the decorative bit. If you go to like a Gothic church, you've got the pointy door at one end, and you've got all of this sort of repeated arches around it, expanding out like a kind of offset function.
Ah, right. So above the main entrance.
Yes. Yeah, and right around often, it as well, like a porch almost. Like.
Yes, often there's like a decorative tympanum, which is the sort of semicircular-ish bit above the door.
Which is how he imagines what basically you're going to have above all your sash windows on Gower Street.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yes.
And then at the top of each arch, there'll be a little shield, probably, of the heraldic crest of the family that lives
Come
there.
Come on, John, let's make it happen.
Yeah.
So we kind of go through the structural elements of the building.
And then the apertures.
And then the apertures, and then various other bits. And then ornament as something which is applied to the building.
Yeah, and as it's applied to the different elements of the building.
Yeah.
There's a key bit at the beginning where he sort of says what ornament is.
About the difference between ornament and art. Yeah, he wants to make a distinction between ornament on the one hand and art on the other. He says that no perfect piece, either of painting or sculpture, is an architectural ornament at all, except in that vague sense in which any beautiful thing is said to ornament the place that it is in. Thus we say that pictures ornament a room, but we should not thank an architect who told us that in his design, to be complete, required a Titian to be put in one corner of it, and a Velasquez in the other. The other thing he says of ornament is that the especial condition of true ornament is to be beautiful in its place and nowhere else.
Yeah.
So the kind of the
sure.
Yeah.
That's just saying that the chapter does two things. What is good ornament? This whole second part of the book, and what ornament should you put in which bit of a building? So he goes through a slightly abbreviated list of all the things he's described in the first section. You know, how should we ornament shafts?
Yes.
Shaft bases. How should we ornament archivolts?
Yeah. Well, what's the answer?
Man is drawn to God. God's creation is great. So the things that we are naturally drawn to are representations of some of the spirit of God's work. And all ornamentation is a sort of observed distilling of a spirit of some sort of natural thing. All geometric ornamentation comes from rocks and crystals. Some ornamentation comes from animals, some from people, birds, fishes. And the pinnacle of... And the primal, most important, comes from plants, and particularly leaves and foliage. Because we are naturally drawn to things in creation and the spirit of them, and that's what makes ornament good, is when somehow the spirit, the God spirit of the leaves has been distilled somehow into the scene. That seems like a strange thing, but he's talking about that. This is something he's going on about all the time. It's really important.
Yeah, so those are the proper sources, the sources on which it's legitimate to draw.
He says those sources are the only sources. And it's not that classical ornament doesn't draw on those sources. All ornament can only draw on those sources, but some is corrupt and some is not corrupt.
Right, yeah.
He keeps saying things very firmly and very surely in a sort of mad lecturing kind of way without any shadow of a doubt. And some of it is very strange. How are we going to do this? All I can think of is a litany of examples. What he thinks is good and what he thinks is bad.
Well, I think we've got to stop talking about them, because I think we should try and move on to talking about the second book quite soon.
Yeah. So, I mean, he sort of says what's appropriate for various, you know, some things like rich stone, some things you want to coat in gold. This is a good style of mosaic to have here. This is a bad style of mosaic to have there. And then, but he has got a good plate, which is a load of lines that he've got from nature. So you've got the line of the ridge of the Alps. You've got the line of a certain sort of leaf. You've got the line of a shell, various ones. And they're sort of blown up. And he said, these are a series of ideal lines from nature. And these could be the sections of your column base. Or these could... And then he says, but you couldn't really use the line of the Alps because it doesn't look right.
Yeah, it's very funny. And it's a very bizarre and charming little moment in the book. He talks about all of these different lines. He says, you know, this line is 1.5 to 2 miles long. And it's the ridge line of this place in the Alps. And then some of them are lines from little seashells.
There's this one leaf that he talks about all the way through all three volumes. Well, no, for the first two volumes.
There's one which is the side of a willow leaf. Lots of mountain lines. A spiral traced on paper round a circular worm. A salvia leaf.
Salvia leaf!
Yeah.
He talks about salvia. Salvia leaf is the best curve.
Is it good? Yeah. That is sort of nice. Yeah. It's very charming. I'll put this on Instagram. I'll put a bunch of the diagrams up. But this, you know, rather like his obsessive drawing of clouds in Modern Painters, it's one of the moments where I think you rather warm to his obsessiveness and his incredible fascination and sort of luxuriation in detail. I'm looking through it now. The illustrations are quite delightful. Here we've got, leaf is a plate called Leafage of the Venetian Capitals, and it's got 1 to 14, and there are all these little fragments, but they're completely, you know, they're completely severed from any context.
Listed as, you know, rustic original style, sadly affected by the Byzantines' failure to understand human proportion or something, but fundamentally honest in spite of it, going through rudeness, sort of some sort of perfection, and then horrific decline.
Yeah, they're very charming.
He's interested in details, the components of buildings, and it's very clear from the way that he talks about them that he spent a great deal of time drawing, measuring, gone up and really traced the section of many, many columns or chimneys or balconies or, you know, there's a long section on the decoration of on corbelling to support sculptures, which he derives that with lots of sections of different corbels, which he's very clearly measured himself.
Yeah.
But with no interest of what they're supporting.
No.
Or how the way that looks really is subservient in the sort of overall aesthetic thing to what's on top of it.
I know it is a bit hack to do this sort of like historical diagnosis thing, but he gives the impression of being somewhat on the spectrum at times between this and the great fondness for staring at rocks
so much painting rocks. Yes.
He
would get out first thing in the morning with nothing but a trusty valet and a ladder and go around Venice climbing up the building, spend 3 hours measuring up a chimney piece or a column or a bit of thing, and then come down off the ladder, be brushed down by his valet who kept the various sort of drawing supplies. Later on, he'd managed to train a valet to operate the camera, and he would send the valet out to... A lot of the pictures are actually taken by various of his sort of butlers and servants and things.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
You look very carefully at his paintings, his famous paintings of Venetian buildings. They will blur out... Not only all the things that he thinks are bad, almost, and they will be, a lot of them are paintings of a frieze, or of a bit of a frieze. The Cador, he's painted most of it, but then he doesn't really like, even though it's Gothic, he doesn't really like the sort of plain bit with square windows on the side of it, so that's sort of blurred out.
Yeah, no, he has these different methods of, we could talk about it a little bit, but these different modes of representation. Yeah, that's definitely one, is the lovingly rendered fragment which sort of swims out of kind of murky obscurity. And yeah, it might be, there's a lovely one of a Byzantine column capital which has this very detailed, very kind of rich but also very on the surface sort of carving, which is all very lovingly rendered. Then there's also these various other more or less diagrammatic kind of collecting of fragments as well, which is a big part of the
I don't know how many of them come from books and whether he measured all of them, but actually I think he probably measured most of them. He must have had drawers full of
sketches
that he'd done, measured drawings of section lines and things.
Yeah.
He was very interested in geology and the scientific drawing, and I think the sectioning of, you know, getting these profiles, all these profiles of cuts through of columns and profiles of cuts through of mouldings, which there are tons of in the book. And he'll just array far more than you needed for any point. He wants to sort of put them into an evolutionary pattern, but he doesn't. He just shows them all.
We've sort of failed to condense what the sort of essential principles of that first part are. And I think in part that's because it's not really possible to. We took a break just now, and when we were talking, the kind of metaphor occurred to me of these like little collections of fragments, which are how he represents all the architecture. And in a way, the whole volume is a bit like that. It's lots and lots of things, but apart from eventually sort of exhausting the list of all of the different general elements of architecture that he can think of, they don't really amount to a composed whole in synthesis.
He's not able to put the bits of the building together. In the preface, he says, in this section, I'm going to lay out so that anyone, even the most stupid reader, he doesn't say stupid, he says, it's a synonym, even the most stupid and ignorant reader will be able to look at any building and understand whether it's good or not. Which is why he will produce so many lists and categories of things and then say what the okay, good and bad versions are of them. But that's a long way from a unified. He fails to say what makes good architecture other than it is made of good components.
And the rules for each of those are different.
Well, they have some alignment. I mean, the things that we've emphasised, like it must be a truthful representation of nature, but the true in spirit.
Oh, well, I guess we better go on to volume two then. So this is...
Oh, sorry. I've remembered another thing. It also is very important that it's true to the people. It talks a lot about the races of Ham or the Lombards. And if a Lombard were to do an Egyptian thing, or if the people of Ham were going to imitate...
The people of Ham are Arabs?
I think they're the descendants of Ham.
But are they Occidental? Are they Oriental?
I think they're the Near Orient.
Okay.
But maybe Egyptians as well. The only thing I know about Ham is he's the one who uncovers Noah's nakedness when Noah is drunk.
Yes.
And I'm only inferring what Mr. Ruskin has said.
Good old Ham.
Who the people of Ham are.
He's a lad. He's a legend.
Yeah. Yeah, well, he did. Anyway, yes. Noah
was a bit drunk.
The others
are Shem and, like, Jashep or something, aren't they?
I have no idea.
Anyway.
We didn't do the people of Ham at Sunday school.
No.
We just about did do the nakedness of Noah, drunkenness of Noah. Sorry,
drunkenness. Yeah. Well, let's go on to the sea stories. So he wrote and released the volume separately.
Needless to say, the first volume was not a bestseller,
and the second volume adopts a completely different approach. Is the other thing to say. So that at the end of the first volume, and we put this in at the end of the last episode, there's this kind of imaginary journey, and we sort of reach a place where we catch a glimpse of Venice. And he is now going to go through, it's sort of half history and half kind of travel.
Would you say it's ekphrasis?
Oh, there's an awful lot of ekphrasis, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
see episodes 1, 2, 3, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know when we defined it. Anyway, ekphrasis is a description which is itself a work of art.
It's like a description which is a story in this case.
In this book, he's going to sort of talk about Venice being founded and it coming about, and he's also going to sort of take a turn around some of the most important locations, some of them real and existing and some of them imagined or kind of excavated out of the past and memory. So some of the places really exist and you can go to them today,
although in his view hideously disfigured.
Yeah, so there's this chapter, The Throne, which kind of talks a lot about how desolate it must have been for a long time.
It's a natural fortress. That's why they're on the islands. I think the phrase that I was taught in history was, following the fall of the Roman Empire, there was a radical simplification of material culture.
Yes. That's a wonderful euphemism.
And during this radical simplification of material culture, you might want to live on somewhere where the marauding simplifiers...
Yeah, can't come and burn your house down. I think maybe we don't need to say that much about the throne, but we could. The chapter which follows it is this one on Torcello, which
it's a really lovely chapter.
It's really beautiful, and I think demonstrates, I mean, the particular approach here, which is about
It's one of the several really good things about the Stones of Venice. I feel like I've been a bit hard on it, but find a bit, and I'll sort of describe the structure of it. It starts, as many of them do, with him stepping onto a gondola, I think, going out of Venice. Torcello is quite an outlying island, way beyond Murano, and he goes out past the graveyard, then goes past various other islands.
The beginning is, it's all famous. 7 miles to the north of Venice, the banks of sand, which near the city rise little above the low watermark, attain by degrees a higher level, and knit themselves at last into fields of salt morass, raised here and there into shapeless mounds and intercepted by narrow creeks of sea. One of the feeblest of these inlets, after winding for some time among buried fragments of masonry and knots of sunburnt weeds whitened with webs of fucus, stays itself in an utterly stagnant pool beside a plot of greener grass covered with ground ivy and violets. On this mound is built a rude brick campanile of the commonest Lombardic type, which, if we ascend towards evening, and there are none to hinder us, the door of its ruinous staircase swinging idly on its hinges, we may command from it one of the most notable scenes in this wild world of ours. Far as the eye can reach, a waste of wild sea moor, of a lurid ashen grey, not like our northern moors with their jet-black pools and purple heath, but lifeless, the colour of sackcloth, with the corrupted seawater soaking through the roots of its acrid weeds and gleaming hither and thither among its snaky channels. To the east, the paleness and roar of the Adriatic, louder at momentary intervals as the surf breaks on the bars of sand. To the south, the widening branches of the calm lagoon, alternately purple and pale green, as they reflect the evening clouds or twilight sky, and almost beneath our feet on the same field which sustains the tower we gaze from, a group of 4 buildings, 2 of them a little larger than cottages, though built of stone. The third, an octagonal chapel, of which we can see little more than the flat red roof with its rayed tiling. The fourth, a considerable church with nave and aisles, but of which, in like manner, we can see little but the long central ridge and the lateral slopes of roof, which the sunlight separates in one glowing mass from the green field beneath and the grey moor beyond. There are no living creatures near the buildings, nor any vestige of village or city round about them. They lie like a little company of ships, becalmed on a faraway sea.
Is that before? When does he got the bit where the people are retreating from their burned city and the attacks of the Lombards? And
that is the start. Maybe it goes on to that afterwards. I mean, we should just describe. So yeah, it's this kind of outlying island. The buildings on it are very old.
Torcello was in a way a rival to the Rialto, which became Venice, and it was a great trading port in the 8th, 9th, 10th century, but it never recovered from the Black Death, I think.
Ah, right, yeah, that's the story, isn't it?
And by then, Venice was the big place anyway. And so it became depopulated.
Yeah, and they are these lovely little monuments. I think that the description is so... There's something almost weird about the way in which the land is kind of characterised as forming itself into this little island, and then all of these kind of snaking weeds and these eerie, like, rotten, whitened things.
You really see powerfully the way Ruskin views the world, which is that the place is a desolate place. It's been abandoned by people. Those bleached vegetation and rotten stone, like bleached bones in the sun, but also eerily beautiful. And you can see how everything really is interconnected. The story of the people, their inhabitation, the harshness, you know, the... In his story, the Lombards come and burn the town, and then they go off and build this basilica under the red skies of their burnt villages. And that human story and the story of the landscape and its creation are inextricably linked. And that really is his sort of world. The reason I keep banging on about, like, how everything is nature and nature is God, or like, and that everything is interlinked, you know, human society, the natural world, the divine spirit are all really all not the same thing, but sort of different sides of the same coin for him, I think. The bits that we're quoting are these sort of poetic. He switches registers between poetic and
Kind of lists.
Hectoring lists.
Yeah. And he'll go into lists later in this chapter, but he starts with this like sort of exquisite kind of drift out into the mire and the murk and then up into this abandoned and beautiful place. And there's a reason why he's starting us off there is because it's this very old fragment of Venice before the glory and certainly before the fall.
And it's the main built, there's a little town hall, but there's a basilica, quite plain now, but with two walls of very famous mosaics, which he describes a little bit, although he puts most of his time into describing the columns, I think, if I remember rightly. The shafts. The shafted hall.
Good shaft action. There's plenty of that. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you are in Venice, it's worth making the trip out there. It's still rather lovely. The journey he takes us, we're kind of circling inward, really, aren't we? Because he goes through the other islands, then we're going to end up at St. Mark's and the Doge's Palace, I think. Isn't that right?
Okay, we can do pot quiz. The throne.
Yeah.
Torcello.
Yeah.
Murano.
Yeah.
The Byzantine palaces.
No. First St. Mark's.
St. Mark's. The Byzantine palaces. Yeah. There may be two sections of Byzantine palaces.
Yeah, there's a Byzantine period and then there's a Gothic bit.
What's after the Byzantine...
The nature of Gothic.
The nature of Gothic!
Which is, yeah. So in the middle of this book, there's this essay called The Nature of Gothic.
Which is very different to the rest of it. And then we're off into, is it the Gothic palaces and then the Doge's Palace?
Yeah. So do you want to say anything about Torcello or Murano or St. Mark's?
So Torcello's got some interesting things, although he's sort of, it's one of the rare points where he puts some emphasis on proportion, and he likes the honesty and abandonment of it. Murano, like a lot of these chapters, there's a long sort of emphasis on the religious story of its foundation. This idea that there's something true underneath that's been sort of mucked up by subsequent generations of redevelopment. I thought, before reading this, he was someone who really liked the Gothic and really didn't like everything else. And in Murano, and other places as well, you see this isn't true. He regards the Byzantine style as just as capable of bearing some of the aspects of truth and beauty and, you know, the things you will call the nature particularly of the Gothic. A lot of that can be ascribed to this pre-Gothic building. But he thinks it's been horribly compromised subsequently. But I think it's quite nice that he shows that he's open-minded. So Marx, he thinks, is extremely important. And he writes about really at great length. And that's where the architecture of encrustation is theorized and developed, which is, he sort of wants everything to be truthful originally. He's got this basis where he thinks things should be truthful, so things should be stone all the way through. But then he really likes St. Mark's, and St. Mark's isn't like that, so he has another theory.
The starting point is that walls should express their materiality and should express structural truth. But then actually he is prepared for the idea that you can decorate with fine materials, which necessarily have to be thinner. But then in St. Mark's, it's a kind of an interior of complete like decorative superabundance. If you've ever seen like images of it, or if you've ever been there, it's covered in mosaic. There's gold everywhere. All of the interior surfaces, all the way up onto the vaults and the insides of the domes and everything, are all, as he says. I mean, encrustation is a good word to describe it, isn't it?
His theory, to sort of explain it, is, it is expressing the structural truth, because the structural truth is you can't chip all of the stone in. So the structural truth is it'll be made of brick and have loads of stuff on it. He's got mixed and conflicted opinions about the incrustation, I think. It's suggested to me that he imagines this era of medieval cities, that if you had walked down the main street of a medieval city, he thinks you would see everywhere gold. Buildings would be encrusted in gold and brightly coloured marbles. There would be lapis. and blood-red stone on all the buildings, and everything would be super brightly coloured. Well, not everything, but, you know, the merchants' houses would be encrusted in this beauty, and the great princes. And he thinks that somehow this is something that's been lost. But he also has this thing that he says, the most difficult thing to judge is colour. And one of the qualities that he finds so most important in Venice is the colourfulness of the buildings. And he says, well, we will have words on that later, and never really explains it.
There's a quotation where he sets out some of the pitfalls of this particular way of looking that he has. For this work of the imagination, there must be no permission during the task which is before us. The impotent feelings of romance, so singularly characteristic of this century, may indeed gild, but never save, the remains of those mightier ages to which they are attached like climbing flowers, and they must be torn away from the magnificent fragments if we would see them as they stood in their own strength. I think what he's saying is that we shouldn't attach too much longing or imagination, that what we have to do is to rigorously examine only what exists rather than what it might conjure up for us. So the imagination is sort of to be excised, but...
Something that really fires his imagination is the partial decay. He loves the grime of ages in St. Mark's. He loves the flooding and the bits of plants growing out of the walls. And when this is kind of tidied up, he feels a terrific sense of loss.
But equally, in the contemplation of the ruins themselves, he's immediately into this kind of other sort of dream world fired by the aesthetic appreciation, isn't he? It's anything but a precise sort of description. It's all mood. It's all...
And beyond mood, I mean, it's the description of saints and the intercession of... I mean, he's for an evangelical, he's got rather swept up in this Catholic thinking. But, you know, the God and saints and the lives of these people really move the stone.
He does this thing, which I don't even understand what the point of it is, but which is very much a sort of characteristic manoeuvre, where he says, "And now I wish that the reader, before I bring him into St. Mark's Place, would imagine himself for a little time in a quiet English cathedral town, and walk with me to the west front of its cathedral." And he goes through this long imaginary composite description of a cathedral town, walking down little narrow alley, not walking on the grass in front of the cathedral, coming round, sort of standing in, looking at the sort of the shadows around the door where various statues have been struck out in kind of Puritan times. And then we go on and on and on, and it goes on and on and on. And there's a lot of rugged sculpture and confused arcades, shattered and grey, grisly with heads of dragons and mocking fiends, worn by the rain and swirling winds, blah, 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 blah. There's lichen. And it ends with the crowd of restless birds that fill the whole square with that strange clangour of theirs, so harsh and yet so soothing, like the cries of birds on a solitary coast between the cliffs and sea. In his imagination, things always recede into like a moment of kind of ineffability or intangibility or something.
He gets very excited by these old buildings and feels this sublime oceanic feeling that we bang on about.
But it kind of draws him out of himself, doesn't it?
That's what the sublime oceanic feeling is, isn't it? It's like where you feel connected to everything out of yourself. And you feel this sense of the infinite, which isn't you in the infinite. It's like this idea of this big expansive thing. And that's sort of what he's trying to... That's what he really likes. But it's something that's actually just inside you. It's not there out in the world. It's very easy to feel this feeling of like being in touch with the infinite or this very great excitement. But actually, that's just an emotion in you.
He's drawn out by motion, like colour, texture, this sort of sadness. Everything is broken. Everything is worn. Everything is sort of displaying these marks of decay. The colours are still kind of vivid. They're not necessarily bright, but he's always describing the kind of burnt colours, which are all the more vivid for being sort of in a kind of dusk light. Slowly, that visual richness sort of draws him out, and then at the end, he's just left with the sound of the birds, which could be the sound of some other birds in another place far away, in kind of a wild place that's not here. Well, he certainly has moments where that's what the description is doing. And I feel like it's such an important part both of these moments of real beauty in the book, which I think, returning to it, I find are still very powerful. And so I have a question, which is, we've got two options. We could stay with this feeling of melancholy for a little bit and sort of talk about Ruskin in Venice and his life, and then finish off with the...
Let's do that.
Yeah?
I think it's worth saying where he was in his life. He was married. He'd fallen in love with this girl who he'd known. I mean, he writes a fairy tale for her, which is his first book, when she's 12 or something like that, and he's 20.
The King of the Golden Mountain. This is a moralistic fairy story.
And it's about a valley, you know, with a waterfall of glistening gold light. And,
yeah. There are three brothers, and two of them are naughty, and one of them is good, and the good one is rewarded in the end.
Yes. That sort of thing. And also, it's not too stimulating. Thank heavens for little girls, for they grow up in the most delightful day, and little girls get bigger every day. And he married her when she turned 20.
What was that from?
It's a song. When she turns 20 and he turns like 30, they get married. And they're married for 6 years. And on their honeymoon, they go to Venice. And this is an interesting thing to do, because Venice has just... It had been ruled by the Austrians since the end of the Napoleonic War, along with a big chunk of northern Italy. And the Italians did not like this one bit. And when there was a insurrection in Austria and in Hungary in 1848, they rebelled and had quite a bit of success.
But yeah, we were saying that like the city had been heavily shelled.
It had been heavily shelled. And actually, subsequently, there's a note from Effie Gray. That's her name, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she said, we were walking along in the street and in St. Mark's Square, they were burning the currency of the old republic, and everyone was gathered around crying, and they were bringing out all the notes and burning them in the square. This is the situation. It's like going to Aleppo.
Yeah, honeymoon in Aleppo. Yeah,
the war has kind of barely or not really finished. The city is sort of bombed out and full of occupying soldiers playing their brass band music. They're socializing with Venetian aristocrats and the Austrian. In fact, both of them are socialising with this guy who'd organised the attempted use of balloons to bomb the city, which hadn't worked out very well, and an Austrian engineer. You know, that's sort of the people they're socialising with, and he gets them into all sorts of buildings and things because the Austrians can do that. And on their honeymoon, Ruskin is getting up early in the morning, going out, sketching, you know, as previously described, climbing all over the roofs and things, and being looked at as being rather strange, and Effie Gray is socialising with military officers.
Also, famously, not having sex.
Not having sex.
They're not having sex.
There's not really any evidence that Ruskin ever had sex with anyone. A bit later than this, when they came back, she wasn't getting any attention. They certainly weren't having sex. He didn't really know how to have a relationship, I think. And eventually, she fell in love with Millet. And he was the great sponsor of Millet. And she sued for an annulment, which was granted on grounds of...
Non-consummation.
No, on irreconcilable... No, on incurable impotence.
Incurable impotence, okay.
He wrote an angry letter saying that he could prove his potency any time, or something like that. But she got the annulment and went on to have lots of children. But they were married for 6 years. He spoke about this as if this marriage was something of really little importance in his life, sort of minor mistake or a little thing that sort of happened at some point. But I can't think, you can't be married to someone for 6 years. I mean, they were living together for nearly all that time.
They'd had an engagement and like a long sort of...
Yeah, I mean, since she was like 11. And later on in life, he goes through... most famously with one girl, but a whole series of infatuations with prepubescent girls. And there's a lot of argument about what this means. For me, there's a couple of things that is obviously he's attracted to. He can't quite cope with a grown-up relationship of equality. And so he's attracted to...
Yeah, with anyone, I think.
With anybody. So he's attracted to people who can sort of be put into a context and he doesn't have to deal with them in that kind of equal way. He's very attracted to, he's absolutely obsessed with Dante, and he really wants people to be like, you know, in the Commedia, in the cycle, the big figure is Beatrice, who's this woman he sees as a girl, is infatuated with, I mean, sees, literally looks at, and then sees another couple of times, and then dies when she's young, and is this model of innocence and perfect Christianity and unattainable romance. And he meets her in heaven, and she guides him through heaven. And it seems to me that that's a bit like what he wants his relationships to be like. He, all these people, he draws their faces as sort of beautiful, cherubic, and innocent, perhaps spiritually in contact with something other. But he also wants to marry them. Like, there's Rose, is it Rose Latouche?
Yeah. So this is the woman he proposes to when she was 21, and he was...
No, he first proposes to her when she was 15 or 16, and her parents say, no way, and you're, and on top of that, you're never seeing her again.
But he was in his 60s, was he at that point?
No, not quite that old.
He was very, very seasoned.
But he would, he kept, eventually she said...
She'd think about it.
She'd think about it, and she said she would agree to get married as long as they just lived together as friends and never had sex. And that was explicit in the marriage contract, and he said, I can't do that because of my reputation. And then she died young, and then actually I think the obsession with her never goes away. He's part of his spiritual reawakening is he goes to a seance and speaks to her spirit through the medium of...
Oh my God.
Through the medium.
Yeah.
And then discovers a new form of Christianity through this, where she literally is... This is my stupid theory, the Beatrix theory, but I think it literally... I think he literally sees it like that. He speaks to her dead spirit through this medium, discovers a new kind of heaven.
I can't feel that marriage is really about sex. Like, I feel like marriage is meant to sort of fill some other kind of hole in his sort of picture.
Well, there's family, isn't there? So his parents are quite old. They're very close. His mother lives with him this enormous amount of time. They're very close. You know, every time they met, they'd read the Bible. And they read it through. And they, well, the way they read the Bible is they just did it chronologically from... You start at Genesis and you go to the Revelation of St. John. And then when you finish, you go over it again. They did that a lot. But the, I mean, the family was close and loving and clingy. And it seems to be quite strange. I don't think it's 100% asexual. I don't mean about consummation. I think I suspect it's 100% unconsummated. But I don't think psychologically it's 100% asexual. Or rather, I don't think the sexual urge is completely out of it. But I think it is weirdly wrapped up with home, family. I think his behaviour, in one sense... In one sense, is a sort of sin. It's a bad thing, which is that I think it was destructive and very unhelpful to a lot of the women.
Yeah, to have this weird old man who's obsessed with you.
That's where I've come down.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's good, but you know.
But I mean, I also don't think.
In the great scheme of people, we look at.
We're talking in the context of a lot of people writing books saying he's a paedophile,
and also like various stories which I think may be made up.
Which ones?
Oh, the famous wedding night story, which I think was just invented by his biographer.
I thought that was invented by Mary Lutyens. She wrote several salacious biographies of people.
Yeah, well, look that one up. It's on the Wikipedia page.
Oh, God. If you can't tell people to go checking our facts.
For me, certainly, when you're reading all of, you know, description after description in which the kind of the self kind of journeys into the visual, journeys into kind of sublimity, and then kind of annihilates itself. But, and I found this nice quotation from Walter Benjamin about melancholy, which I thought sort of resonated. This is from, I think it's from The Origin of German Tragic Drama, which I've put, he says, melancholy betrays the world for the sake of knowledge, but in its tenacious self-absorption, it embraces dead objects in its contemplation, in order to redeem them. The persistence which is expressed in the intention of mourning is born of its loyalty to the world of things.
Not melancholy is kind of being social, isn't it?
You'd sort of turn your face to the rock collection somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Like you'll get well into maths or get well into geology or beauty or aesthetics or something, and it's quite dry.
Well, it's technically cold and wet, I believe, in the in the Galenic scheme.
I'm not sure how helpful an aid of general understanding Galenic. I mean, we're already kind of slightly down a rabbit hole. And he's melancholic a lot. He has a sort of balance of manic and melancholy. You could probably just rinse through the other bits. St. Mark's, we've kind of mentioned, and he's got a lot of stories about it, but they're kind of nice stories. It's a good bit to read. It's kind of readable, St. Mark's. The Gothic palaces, he talks about the beauty of their facades, really, and, you know, which ones have particular... And he's very sad that people are flogging whole chunks off and ripping the whole thing to pieces. And he imagines this world where it was just these incredibly beautiful palaces. But he's mainly basically talking about the facades. The big thing is the Ducal Palace, which he thinks, I think, is the best building in the world. He gives a long history of it, how the council constructed this thing to be built or that thing to be built, or, you know, originally it's part of this palace. And he talks a little bit about the interior buildings. But the one thing that is absolutely key for him is the column capitals going round, which he devotes most of the section to, and really are his justification of it being the best building in the world.
Yeah, so this is sort of for each column capital, and how many of them? Like
loads.
50, 100?
He doesn't have that many. He writes an essay for each of the ones he thinks are important. Yeah. It's definitely in the teens in terms of essays. Yeah. If you don't know the building, it's a rectangular courtyard building, very tall, with one side of the courtyard missing. And it's got lots of floors of fairly bare brickwork with a rather beautiful pattern on it, and a few windows in roundels, all very pretty. And then the bottom, there's an arcade of these big, fat columns, short, with Gothic arches, big capitals. And you can, on the ground floor, walk around it like a colonnade right round the outside. And there's another one on the inside, which is a bit newer, which he talks about a lot less and as being inferior, because it's not in his Gothic period. He actually doesn't describe all of them at all.
But it's not, I mean, it's enough.
So, for example, he will mention one and say, here you'll see, he's gone on previously about the carvings of the months of the year in Gothic. Here you'll see some carvings of months of the year, appendix. And then there is the months of the year in 15 different things, English poetry, in this poem, in this thing, and there's a huge chart of what they've all got, and then he'll describe them. So, you know, April. In Spenser, April is doing this and this, like this. But in the cathedral at Padua, it's doing this and this and this. And he goes into enormous length in the quality of the carving. This sculptor's got really good leaves and they really embody the spirit of God, but his carving of people is a bit rubbish. One of them, as a footnote, he has the plot of Dante's Inferno, not the whole Commedia, laid out canto by canto as a necessary adjunct to understanding...
Yeah, what's going on.
...this column capital.
Yeah.
Which has got nothing to do with Dante.
Yes.
Why do you think he's doing this?
I don't know. I mean, I think that this is what he loves about it.
I mean, actually, I think thinking the Doge's Palace is the best building ever is a strange thing.
It is strange. It's a striking building. I love it. Sort of, it's
flat and boxy.
Yeah, very boxy. It's got this kind of plaid masonry on the outside in the upper stories, which is kind of cool. It's very graphic. I don't know why particularly, because also it's not one which then naturally proposes what does the city of the Doge's Palace look like. I mean, apart from
with his architecture, he's not really interested in the interiors of buildings. Or rather, the only sort of interiors he's interested in are huge halls. He's got no interest at all in planning, as in laying out plans of buildings or what goes where or how spaces interrelate.
Yeah.
He never describes at any point moving from one room into another room.
No. No.
Which is one of the big things in architecture. He never describes
it's all landscape.
The experience of walking from one place to another place.
Well, it's all about the stones, isn't it? The stones, and I guess this really is the demonstration that he's been building up to, that the stones speak. Each of them has its own...
carving? Each stone has its own carving?
Well, each stone has its own little story.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's something very romantic about that kind of richness, isn't
there?
But
I think that leads us into the nature of Gothic, doesn't it?
I guess it does,
These stones are, for him, the column capitals around the Doge's Palace are... The best thing in architecture?
The exemplar.
The best thing in... Do you think that's defendable? Do you think that he thinks that the column capitals in those are the best piece of architecture?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. No, I think that seems correct.
The best architectural expression man has ever come up with. I think it's probably a bit of, ever will come up with.
I think as a position, it's quixotic, but it's his position. Yeah.
Are the capitals going round two sides of the outside of the Doge's palace?
Yeah. That's the best bit. Yeah. I mean, you just come. There are places you come back to, aren't there?
I think it's at least partly because of his sort of idea of the nature of Gothic. So people tend to skip the whole of the Stones of Venice and just read this one chapter, which is extremely unlike it, and was published almost immediately as a standalone text. William Morris said it was the most important utterance of the 19th century.
It's an attempt to define exactly what the qualities are of Gothic architecture, of good Gothic architecture, and it's not doing it by element, but rather by the qualities which sustain, generate, and which are sort of displayed by it to some extent. The architecture could be thought of to some extent, I think, as a sort of second order consequence of these underlying generative qualities, and there are six.
I'd read it before.
Yeah.
This, but I listened to it this time, waiting for a plane in Gatwick Airport. Got my sandwich, wandering around. I arrived very early, and I listened to it all in the airport, which made it sort of seem quite strange. The first thing, a full double barrel assault on the industrial economy.
Yeah.
On the division of labour, machine made. He has an idea of the dignity of labour, which is that people make things, will put their soul into it. And really, when he's talking about labour, he means stone carving.
Yeah, yeah. The like decorative.
Basically, labour is
guys and
carving
chisels.
Ornament on stones.
Yeah.
And the dignity of labour is that the man has a creator. He produces this whole thing himself. It has some of his spirit and some of the way he sees nature in it. And it makes him into a dignified, creative being. He does always say him, it's okay.
It's not us.
His world, he has some problems with women.
Yeah.
But the industrial economy has made a man a tiny fraction of a man by doing two things. Instead of releasing his creative energy, he has focused all his energy into becoming more like a machine, to become a perfect recreator of this thing again and again. It has created a slave class. He thinks he's got ideas of different sort of classes of man, and he thinks the architecture of the peoples of Ham, again, which is, I think he sort of imagines it like a sort of emperor pharaoh whipping everyone into line.
Mm. Yeah, people turning out all the like millions of tiles on the Ishtar Gate or whatever.
Is bad, but at least they're making whole tiles.
Yeah.
But the industrial economy is much worse than that, because they're just becoming components of machines. And he literally takes on Adam Smith's pin factory and says, how can you make someone's whole spirit be putting the end on a pin?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or sharpening a pin. This is in The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith says, well, if you get a man to make a pin from metal, it'll take him all day. But if you've got like 20 people, one is drawing out wire, one is chopping up the wire, one is putting the head on the pin, one is sharpening the pin, one is putting it in little paper packets or whatever, they can produce thousands of pins. And his response to that is, but you're making a man, instead of building a Gothic cathedral, instead of carving Tracy in a Gothic cathedral and having his energy go into that and that giving him a sublime feeling, all his energy is coming to sharpening pin heads, which is way less than a person should be.
And so, a Gothic architecture, first and foremost, will be one which enables that expression, that like creative expression. No one is carrying out someone else's orders, essentially, in the kind of idealized sense, are they?
The society is the hierarchy, but the hierarchy is natural. Everyone will rise to their level of natural quality, which will be a hierarchical pyramid society with the good at the top. And the quality that is separating them is sort of intelligence, really, like natural cleverness, like you're clever with your hands and he has an assault on education as well.
Yeah, there'll be a bit of design and so on, but nobody is going to be, you won't be handing someone a drawing of a carving or something and saying, no, do it like this.
And in fact, I think the way the natural thing works is that the people, the deltas, their whole soul probably is consumed in just like laying mortar or whatever.
Yeah, for, then, very beautifully.
You know, when at the next stage up, their natural level of development maybe is carving the leaves or something. And then, you know, some people will be finer and do figures or whatever. I think he sort of is in two minds about that.
Yeah.
But he alludes to it.
Yeah, and I think he certainly has in mind the kind of earlier buildings of the Gothic Revival that we talked about in the last episode, a little bit in particular, these kind of sort of Chelsea Gothic, you know.
Yeah, but also just that, like, if it's pre-drawn, it's going to be soulless.
Yeah.
And he actually says it's a very good sign if a building's rough.
Much better for it to be rough than for it to be corrupt, yeah.
And he says, it is possible for a good building to be fine. There are a couple of good examples of fine Gothic buildings, but there are only a couple. And if you don't know, it's best to assume that if it is well executed mechanically, it is bad. Because it's much more important that it be true to a nature of production than it be precise and well finished. And he talks a lot of, most men cannot be artists, and you can't train them to being artists. Most people have no natural genius, so you can either make them execute something mechanically perfectly, in which case they become machines, or you can get them to execute themselves badly, in which case you'll have the rough Gothic. I mean, well, not necessarily badly, but like inaccurately. He sort of prefers children's drawings to stencil drawings, or, you know, whatever.
So should we do the qualities? I might just read them all out and then we can go through them.
Yeah, because there are...
Which are, in order of importance, first, savageness, second, changefulness, third, naturalism, fourth, grotesqueness, fifth, rigidity, and sixth, redundance. I mean, the savageness is to do with being produced by a climate which is not easy, or coming out of a sort of set of circumstances where you have to work very hard and where you have to sort of battle against the elements. So
the real problem in modern life, which is that we don't sacrifice everything for our art. The middle classes are just not prepared to work themselves to death in order to build beauty, which is how it should be. He thinks no great buildings will be achieved without suffering. It should be like the god fills you with energy and you devote yourself to nothing but building the cathedral.
Well, it's
great things are made.
Physical suffering rather than boredom. Yeah, there's a lot of purple writing here. He talks about this magnificence of sturdy power, the outspeaking of the strong spirit of men who may not gather redundant fruitage from the earth, nor bask in dreamy benignity of sunshine, but must break the rock for bread and cleave the forest for fire.
This hardness that they're working makes the buildings sublime, like a mountain.
And it's also then that Gothic is a northern style.
Yeah.
Yeah, which reaches down via the Lombards into...
Yeah, we've talked a lot about the Lombards. This is people who invaded Italy and ran it for a bit after the Romans, and sort of slowly retreated up north. But he's got a slightly strange view of them. But basically, they're Germans.
I don't think we need to say that much more about that one. We could talk about changefulness.
Because the Gothic is all devised by different people, it will have this delight in different things everywhere, because there's so many hearts have gone into it.
This is one which is very obviously part of the appreciation of real Gothic architecture, isn't it? Everything is a bit different. There are some high Gothic buildings which are built, as it were, to a single schema, all in one go. But there are relatively few of them, you know. There's sort of, you know, you think of...
Salisbury Cathedral.
Or, yeah, you know, Amiens, where it is like a kind of... It's this sort of perfectly executed. But most of them are not like that. Most of them have got lots of bits.
Within them, there's lots of different style and sort of accretion, I think he thinks is very good. When he tells the story of a great building that he likes, he will go through the story of all the many stages that it took to build it up and then destroy it.
Yeah. So changefulness.
Is that the bit where he has like representations are the good and the bad or both? He's got a really long bit about that. What was that
about? I mean, so he has a bit about, like, naturalism, I think we've already talked about, and we'll come back to, you know, we'll find ourselves revisiting
it. It's a view where naturalism isn't, like, precise representation, but it's like a melding together of lots of different qualities. It's neither too hot nor too cold. It's something which incorporates darkness of life and the goodness of life and represents things truly, but also understands them symbolically. He will go through a long scheme where he'll say, these people represent the evil and are sort of a dark influence and melancholic. These people only represent the good and are insufficient and sort of insipid. These people represent the good and the evil and the good. These people over-stylize. These people are finickety and too precise. These people both stylize and understand precision. They're good. And he'll give long lists of both of them and talk about lots of works, which will have sort of savage critiques of various paintings in London, normally.
So then there's grotesqueness, which I think we will probably talk a little bit about in the context of volume 3.
He's got a rather particular notion of grotesqueness. There's good and bad grotesque, definitely. I think it's because he just likes, like, weird Gothic old buildings with weird carvings on them would be the starting place. But he thinks the sort of savage grotesqueness that represents the deformities of the world is very powerful, and he also thinks it's something that people are naturally drawn to, which is sort of means it's good.
Well, we kind of get onto it in his critique of the Renaissance, but there's a kind of mockery and jesting in Renaissance grotesqueness that he seems to find.
He doesn't like the Renaissance camp, the twiddles and all. The sort of slightly satirical. He wants it to be grotesqueness red in tooth and claw, really.
So then there's rigidity. And so rigidity is a difficult one. The quotation here is, it's not merely stable but active rigidity, the peculiar energy which gives tension to movement and stiffness to resistance, which makes the fiercest lightning forked rather than curved, and the stoutest oak branch angular rather than bending. Well, that's a rather fanciful sort of explanation. But I think that this is a kind of a sculptural idea, isn't it? It's about the expression of force through a particular language.
If you're in the interior of a big Gothic cathedral, you really see the force go down this line, through this line, and you see both the power of the holding up and the power of the pushing down and the precision, the cutness, the sharp cut quality he's interested in there.
And then the final one is redundance. And this one seems, in a way, it's funny that he ranks it sixth because it seems very important, but by redundance he means a sort of superfluity.
And he says it's not necessary.
Yeah.
He says it's not necessary. You can have perfectly good Gothic.
But it's a sort of an ethos of giving more than is necessary. Nothing should be at a minimum. I think the two are related, though, because, I mean, part of the reason why that expression of structure in Gothic buildings is rigid is that they can't quite synthesize the whole movement into one thing. It tends to be articulated as a series of elements which are more or less coordinated, but which have not been composed, as it were, into a single flowing line. And that, in the same way, the redundance is sort of the same thing. It's about this meeting of many different parts which are coordinated, but which have not been finessed and the unneeded elements totally stripped away. And
if you were going to be really practical and say what that means, it's you go into a Gothic room and it's absolutely cut. Every surface is covered in gold, mosaic and sculptures.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad thing.
Which is a bit, I mean, that's a much better definition of Gothic. It's one that I don't think any building could ever meet.
Yeah.
But it's a much better definition than the one given in the first volume, which is no single person could describe what Gothic is, but basically it means pointy windows.
And I think it's also, it's what the building is saying to him, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's speaking in this very powerful emotional register.
It's interesting that most of it doesn't talk about Gothic buildings. When he's talking about changefulness, he really just talks about painters, for example. And not Gothic painters. He talks about Renaissance painters. Some are good, some are bad, some are mediocre. It really, when he says the nature of Gothic, he means the nature of, almost the nature of virtue at times. He sort of confuses the two things. Sometimes he's talking about what makes a building Gothic, and sometimes he's talking about what makes an artwork good or a human endeavour good.
Yes. Well, the two things are very close. I think
I wanted
yeah.
to know a little bit more about how you felt about it, because we've sort of described what's said in the nature of Gothic, and it has several things which I think are real insights which weren't present in the age. It says that one of the qualities that's very present in very old buildings, which isn't present in Gothic Revival, is there's many hands producing the decoration. Gothic Revival buildings are very tight and very precise, and they might be covered in lots of decoration, but it's regularized.
If it breaks from that, as it does in some of Pugin's work, it's because he has this like extraordinary memory of lots of different examples to draw on, which is able to kind of enrich it with more and more.
But I would say even Pugin's best churches, which are very good, are too precise.
Yes, I think it's interesting. And I think it's in a way something which also looks forward about Ruskin, that for him, architecture, the purpose of architecture is inextricably linked to the means of production, to the way in which it's produced, to its relationship to labour and the economy, which is a theme which will sort of resurface at various points from now on after this.
It's been one of the great challenges since architects kind of took control of sophisticated building, how to make something greater than themselves. And it can be done with, you know, nowadays we do it with terrific scale or with complexity of form or... But it's a real challenge how to do something greater than the human mind. I think it's one of the things that people wanted out of computers, which we're talking about. You know, people wanted to be able to escape the limits of the human hand and eye designing something to something better. The Gothic way it makes it better is you just have lots of people, like an ant's nest, you know, making this work of beauty.
Yeah, you have a happy and harmonious kind of godly community.
Well, I mean, that's his proposal, but I mean, in reality, it is true that the Gothic buildings they weren't built in a happy, harmonious, godlike society, but they do have this quality that the decoration in them is often absolutely stunning and vivid and alive in a way that it wouldn't be if it was drawn out by someone, I think. I think it's a real insight. Like, don't think his idea of societies is correct at all, but I think his insight into that good thing about old buildings, some old buildings, is correct.
Yeah, I think it's also, they're made by many people. They're also just, there's an
over a long time.
They're an incredible concentration of thought and energy. Yeah, that's the real thing, isn't it?
But they're able to do that by it not being, by happening by a lot of people over a long time.
Yeah.
It's more rhizomatic or whatever.
It's emergent, yeah.
It's emergent, yeah.
Yeah. It's a slime mold.
But you can see why I'm thinking of computer, because this is sort of computer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the next episode, maybe I'll have read a bit more of it and I can talk about Lars Bybrook's work on Ruskin, which very deliberately, in about 5 minutes of it that I've read, it very deliberately tries to make a connection between the nature of Gothic and the new potential of digital design.
I haven't read it at all, and I hadn't really been thinking about this until I read The Nature of Gothic, but I think there is a connection. I think you can make a connection.
Well, maybe we'll throw that in. I think that'll be interesting. Take us back into the future. For me, what I get out of the Stones of Venice is a bunch of different things. I mean, a lot of it is just good fun. It's this incredibly sort of fruity, strange, obsessive, moralizing, hectoring, funny sort of like rant.
Who said he was like, I mean, it was about the next book, but he said it's like being lectured to death by a mad governess.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's fun. I mean, if you have a taste for this kind of thing, and I do a bit, like the other thing which I get out of it are these passages which we have dipped into of like real beauty, where he has a wonderful, the rhythm of the language, the way in which he sort of paints the landscape, the way in which everything is saturated in this kind of melancholy, brokenness, sadness.
Like, we're really into places and buildings and find them really stimulating, and so does he. When I listen to podcasts, I think, oh, I wish I could be a bit more enthusiastic about things. Because I think it's really nice to get behind this enthusiastic adoption of beauty and good things. But I think his project doesn't work, which is his project is to, like, make his sublime feeling into a scientific system. Again, like Korb, after reading all those bloody Korb books.
Yeah, sure, but that's because the people who write these things are manic, aren't they? They can't have a balanced view of what they're doing because they wouldn't do it if they did.
I don't think he's really into much else of the good life. He's certainly not having much luck with sex. I don't think he's particularly into, like, food and or carousing or, like, having fun at parties. He's not really into that. I would normally put the sort of sublime experience of beautiful buildings and places into the context of the good life of all these other things. So I like the cycle trips, you know. Bit of physical, bit of light cardio in beautiful surroundings, watching the and sort of process of time. Bit of amazing images, bit of good food.
A spritz. Invented by the Austrians.
Some heavy social, yeah.
Yeah, I think we should leave it there because it's going to be just too much. But the nature of Gothic then sort of sets us up for the discussion of the Renaissance and really what it is that he, at
spoiler,
long last, wants
to... He doesn't like it.
He doesn't like it. Well, he's told us that in the introduction, but... But it's taken an awful long time to get there. So we'll get onto that. And then I think we'll sort of spiral outwards a little bit from there and talk about his ideas, you know, where these ideas go in his contemporary context of the industrial society, political economy and all these sorts of things. So thanks a lot for listening. I will be posting various things on the Instagram, Twitter and Mastodon. .social.
I don't think we need to devote ourselves too much to promoting Mastodon.
It's okay. It all happens automatically. Where we're at @about_buildings. And our Patreon is at patreon.com/about_buildings, where you can get bonus content with every episode. As if you haven't had enough of this already.
Some of it's all right. Yeah.
We're going to record it another day.
For the power user or general enlightened sponsor of culture.
But thank you very much to everyone for listening. Do rate and review. That's very helpful helping people to find the podcast. If you can find it in your heart to sign up for the Patreon, that's much appreciated. Thank you very much if you already do. Tell a friend.
Yeah.
Send us an email.
Yeah, no, we have some emails recently and they're...
They're very much appreciated. It's all online if you want to dip into it yourself.
Yeah, it's not hard to get hold of the Stones of Venice.
Yeah, archive.org. There's about a million versions of it.
I think it's okay to look at the pictures first. I read it in the worst possible way, which is like essay crisis, crash reading massive text. It's not the way to enjoy it.
Give yourself a year.
Although it does give you a real insight into his way of talking.
Yeah, no, dip in and out.
A lot of the stuff I've been talking about is under the surface. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
Yes. Well, enjoy Venice. Until next time.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.